Only thing I'm plugging is Forgotten Seasons.
Welcome back to another episode of Forgotten Seasons. This is your host, Dylan Dreyfus. Today we are going to H-Town, reliving the 2009 Houston Rockets season with their all-defensive wing, Shane Battier. This Rocket squad won 53 games, finished as the 5 seed in a loaded Western Conference. Their playoff starting five was Aaron Brooks, Battier, Ron Artest, Luis Scola, and Yao Ming. You'll notice no T-Mac in there. Mac battled injuries all year and eventually called it a season in February. Microfracture knee surgery. Unfortunately, really the beginning of the end for Mac's stint in Houston. Yao, on the other hand, who, as you know, battled injuries just like T-Mac, was healthy this season. He plays 77 games, all NBA second team, but injury strikes at probably the worst possible time. Midway through the conference semifinal versus the Lakers, he breaks his foot, done for the playoffs. That conference semifinals was a classic versus the Lakers. Houston advances past B-Roy in Portland in round one and gets Kobe and the Lakers in round two. Without Mac or Yao, they go toe-to-toe with the eventual champs, take him to seven games. Our guy Battier is the primary matchup versus Kobe, which, as you can expect, comes with some legendary stories. Shane gets into all of that and more. So let's get into it now. Quick reminder to leave a rating and a review if you are coming back to the podcast. Really appreciate it. Forgotten Seasons with Shane Battier on the 2009 Rockets begins right now. I am here with Duke great defensive maestro Shane Battier. Shane, how are you doing today, man?
Dylan, it's great to be here, man. Thanks for having me.
I am very excited to get into this 2008-09 Rockets season. Growing up, I was a huge Tracy McGrady fan. I think these teams were just tantalizing. You got McGrady and Yao, two transcendent talents, but never seemed to really click at the same time. Brutal injury luck. But this season was McGrady goes out and you guys make a run, second round, Lakers, seven games. But just getting into it, sort of a brief oral history of the Rockets. This is year five of the McGrady-Yao era. This is year three for you. 2 years in a row, you guys lose to Utah in round one. If you can remember, like, what is the energy going into this season, 08-09, coming off those two consecutive first round losses to Utah?
Yeah, so in year three, look, first of all, the West was an absolute buzzsaw. Mm-hmm. And most people, you know, it took 50 wins just to get like a five seed, which is like ridiculous. And you talk about Dallas and San Antonio and the Lakers and Portland and just a ton of just really, really good teams in Minnesota. I mean, so like all these teams are really, really good. And so we played a Utah Jazz team, which was stacked. I mean, any other year, you put them in the East and, you know, talking about, you know, D. Will in his prime, Karolinko in his prime, Okur in his prime, you know, Carlos Boozer. I mean, they were a monster. So the tough one in the early years against the Jazz was we lost game seven at home. Not too many teams lose game seven at home, and we did to Utah. Very, very good team in a 4-5 matchup. So, the next year we were banged up. I think Yao was out for that. He didn't play. Mm-hmm. So like, yep. you understand that loss, but you know, we had the confidence that, you know, we were good enough to win it. We thought that we had enough talent. We thought that, you know, we had stars, we had role players, we had great coaching. So optimism was super high, and we were just looking for just one year of health just to try to put it all together.
So the two main storylines going into this season for you guys in the offseason, one is that T-Mac's coming off microfracture surgery, which he talked about is a brutal surgery. And then the second is that you make a big move trading for Ron Artest, who he's been on the show. I'm a big Ron guy, but no denying around that time there were maybe questions, you know, about his character. You guys end up both making all defensive team and really being one of the best wing defensive combinations of that era. First reaction when you heard you guys were making a move to Ron Artest?
Look, I grew up playing against Ron. So Ron and I are both, and T-Mac are all class in 1997. So I knew Ron when we were 13 years old. And I love Ron just because that guy was just a competitor. And, you know, obviously he had a pass with the Palace throwdown, I guess you could say. But no one ever questioned his heart. No one ever questioned his talent. And so I was excited. I mean, but we, you know, to go out there with Ron, who I had a relationship with, I was cool with it. And you can't win in this league without talent. And there's no doubt that Ron was an amazing talent. And, you know, I love playing defense with Ron because he was so different than me. You know, I was about angles and about the strategy, and he was just about, you know, sheer brute force. You know, he had these like meat cleavers for hands, and he was like probably maybe the strongest wing I played against my entire career.
How much did he weigh? How much did he weigh at this time?
He had to be at least 250. At least 250, and like a solid 250, you know. And he go into the weight room, and he didn't lift a lot of weights. I mean, he was like country strong, even though he's from Queensbridge. And you know, he'd throw up, just, you know, put racks on the bench press, and bah, 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 all right, let's go play. And but he was fun to watch. He was fun to watch because he had a lot of antics. But I think he played up a lot of his antics. You know, knowing Ron, he was actually a pretty savvy defender.
Yeah, super nice guy too. I think you see him on the court and you expect his personality to match that. But my experience of him, soft-spoken, super thoughtful guy. So I'm a big fan of Ron too. Sort of question about roster construction. You're with the Heat now as a consultant with their ownership group. We hear so much about the Heat culture. How much do you take into account a player's reputation, how they're going to fit into the locker room? Does that sort of sway you away from certain guys, or are you betting on that Heat culture to be able to shape and mold players when they come in?
Well, in Houston, we had a really strong locker room. You know, you talk about Luis Scola, Rip Ralston, obviously Yao Ming, you know, T-Mac. We didn't have a whole lot of jerks. So we weren't too concerned about Ron and the disruption. You know, Rick Adelman doesn't get enough credit for being an amazing cook. He's in the Hall of Fame now, but he was a legend. And what Rick did better than any other coach I played with on any level, he really gave ownership to the team. And it was never like, this is my team and do what I say. And you know, when we win, it's because of my plan. He really gave ownership to the team. And it felt like it was our locker room. It felt like it was our organization. And it takes a unique mind to do that. And Rick had that. And so when Ron comes into our locker room, you know, we embrace them. No big deal. And as long as you show up and you lace them up, and when it's 7:30 and the ball's in the air, you're ready to go and prepared. We don't care who you are. And that's the beauty of ball. And, you know, so we had no concerns whatsoever with Ron on our team. We're actually pretty happy. We thought we had a strong enough locker room and culture that it didn't matter who would come in our locker room. They were going to help us win.
Well, it works out without McGrady this season, 53 wins, 5 seed in the West, number 4 overall defense. You and Ron, obviously a big part of that. And sort of going into the construction of the roster, one of my favorite parts about this team is just the strength of the role players. You got Kyle Lowry, you got Aaron Brooks, Carl Landry, Von Wafer. Just talk about sort of the balance that this team had to offer going 1 through 8, 1 through 10, where guys are coming in and really shining in their role.
Well, look, you know, Daryl Morey and Sam Hinkie, those are my guys. And they find talent. You can say whatever you want about their methods. Those dudes find talent. And you know, look, we had guys like second round picks, guys off the G League, Mike Harris. We had so much talent on that team. Like, people forget, like, Aaron Brooks was, you know, might have been an all-star, but he was borderline all-star and was absolute crushing. No one can guard him. And Kyle Lowry couldn't sniff the floor. Now, Kyle Lowry's a Hall of Famer. Mm-hmm. And like, it was AB's team, you know, and AB was quick. And when you put him in a pick and roll with Yao Ming, like, he was a handful, right? And the next year, you know, AB gets hurt, Kyle steps in, Kyle becomes an all-star, mm-hmm. right? We had, you know, Carl Landry was an absolute monster. Like, people Beast. Forget, like, he was our go-to player down the stretch. We had Yao Ming, yep. you know, Hall of Famer. We had T-Mac. And we were running turn 4 for Carl Landry, where we just turned him out, gave the ball to Carl on the block, and Carl would go to work. And like Carl Landry, you know, mm-hmm. you pulled Mike Harris out of the Rio Grande Valley Vipers. He wins a game for us that year. Steve Novak, you know, Von Wafer was a revelation. I mean, he was like supposed to be the 14th guy. And he comes in and he was just like, you know, Vinny Johnson of the new millennia. And so, you know, we had amazing talent. We had a play style that was very democratic. And obviously you throw in, you know, the all-stars that we had, you know, talk about Luis Scola. I mean, just, we had so much talent that year. So, you know, we had enough talent to win. There's no doubt we had enough talent to win. It just, we had a lot of bad luck.
Speaking of Maury and Hinkie, I think it's well known Maury was one of the first analytics-driven GM, and I mean, don't have to explain who Sam Hinkie is and what his philosophy is. Were you at all tapped into sort of their philosophy as an analytics-first front office, or are you just staying out of that?
Yeah. I mean, those guys changed my life and my basketball career. They taught me a different way to think about the game, and you know, I spent a lot of time with them before every game, just trying to understand like how they look at players. And so like Sam, you know, I'll never forget before every game, I'd get done with my warm-up and I'd sit down with Sam Hinkie and then he'd sort of quiz me. Okay. What's more dangerous, you know, a Lou Aldang corner three or Kyle Korver wing three, you know, a Kevin Durant dribble off the jumper at the elbow or a, you know, Boki Nachbarth corner three. And so, you know, we sort of gamified it, but I understood all the trade-offs and really how to look at basketball through a data lens. And I knew like what the shots were, you know, forget the players. I understood what the shots were that beat you as a defender and what won you games and what lost you games. Right. And so we did that every game. So I became just, you know, so enamored with the process of just understanding who a guy was, you know, down to the, you know, the percentile. And, you know, I knew guys better than they knew guys, you know, and I knew guys better than guys knew themselves. And it gave me a tremendous advantage on the defensive end. It hurt me on the offensive end because I knew what the answer to the question was. But it was a really, really great way to think about the game. And if I could go back and play for those guys now, I messed up in my career that I actually practiced like a 2-point dribble jumper, right? I wasted like hours of my life practicing jump shots from the elbow, right? If I go back and I'll play, I get 20 rips up from three and that's it. I would never dribble. I would have been a much better player.
Question about sort of just analytics. I mean, when you have such an analytics driven front office, how do you weigh that versus the eye test? You know, you have, it might sound like a stupid question, but there's some guys that maybe don't cater too well to an analytics model. But when you watch them, you know, they look great. They're getting good shots. What is that sort of chess match like in pendulum weighing player that works great in models and one that's just, you know,
it's not either or. You need both. Look, you still need the qualitative, and you can't measure a guy's heart or an IQ or his ability to react or ability to adjust during a game through data. There's some things that may hint, but like you need it all, you know, and the best teams today are the ones that marry the data and sort of the eye test, the qualitative. Like, you know, we have models now where we know exactly what you should be able to shoot from anywhere on the floor, any player in the league, any player in the last 20 years, based on how far the defender is away from you. Right. So we know. So you're not hiding the player. You're not fooling somebody into getting a max contract without the data picking it up. Right. So there's nowhere to hide anymore. But that is not the entire story. There's so much that goes into being a part of a championship winning basketball team. Data is just a part of it and it will never replace it fully, but you can't win without it.
Do you think playing hard now is a skill in today's league?
No, I think guys play hard. I think that the differentiator for the all-stars and for the truly, truly great players and great teams, the ability to think and think under pressure, right? These guys are so athletic now. They're way more athletic than when I played. They're way more skilled than when I played, right? But the great differentiator is can you think the game and can you think it quickly and can you think it under pressure? And you see the guys who can, and you see the guys who can't. All right. So I don't care how high you jump, how fast you are, or how how mad your handle is. If you can't think it, you're not going to be on the floor when it's nutcracking time. And that will always be true for basketball.
That's a great way to put it. Jumping back in real quick, I do want to spend just a few minutes talking about the stars of this team. T-Mac, and yeah, obviously T-Mac's out, but just shedding a little bit of light, you were with him for the two seasons before in Houston. I imagine going up against him in practice sometimes. I'm a part of his Ones Basketball League, which he just launched, trying to find the best one-on-one player. And I just think there couldn't be a better face for that league than Tracy McGrady. Can you just spend just a few moments talking about your memories of being T-Mac's teammate and just how unstoppable he was on the wing?
Yeah, well, look, you know, I grew up again in high school. I was class 97, T-Mac was class 97. And, you know, T-Mac had a really interesting rise. You know, he was really unheralded till I think it was junior year.
Were you at the ABC camp with him?
I was at Nike. I was a Nike guy. He was AB, but okay. You heard about this guy, T-Mac, you know, like where'd he come from? Auburndale, Florida. And, you know, just so explosive, so long, had all the skill set, just really just came on the scene out of nowhere. You just don't see that anymore. And, you know, obviously I guarded him in Toronto for a few years. I was in the Western Conference always, so I saw him twice a year. So you don't see the guys in the conference a whole lot. So you don't really get to know them that well. You know, they're just a handful. T-Mac was an absolute handful and just so aggressive. And you know, he was a monster, you know, especially early in his career before his injuries. When I got to Houston, you know, what struck me about T-Mac that I don't think he gets enough credit for is he's probably the best passer I ever played with.
Ooh,
you know, okay. he was a great pitcher in high school, but he saw everything. And, you know, as a shooter, like you just want the ball in the pocket. Mm-hmm. All right. Like just hit me on my chest and I'm going to give you an assist. And T-Mac, he put that on the money every single time, you know, it could be from up here, one-handed bullet pass. And so like super, super underrated passer and a willing passer. For as good, as great as a scorer as he was and all the accolades for scoring, he was a willing passer and just a really, really savvy basketball player. But, you know, by far the best passer. And I play with some great passers, the best passer that I play with.
I think that's the first time I've heard that, but he did put up some good assist numbers some year. Transitioning to the other head of that two-headed monster, Yao Ming. He plays 77 games this year. It's really his last hurrah in the league and some of his best basketball, 22, 10, and 2. You have any good Yao stories that sort of encapsulate who he is? I've heard that he's sort of underratedly like one of the funnier guys in the league.
Yeah.
Anything you got for Yao?
Yeah, Yao told a great story. You know, he had a charity event at one night and he came to the guys in the locker room and said, "Hey guys, I want to invite you to my charity event, you know, this week. It's so-and-so in Houston. You know, please bring your wives or please bring your girlfriends. Please don't bring both." And I'm like, that's really good. So I think y'all pretended not to speak English very well, so people would leave him alone. But he was actually like hilarious and had a great sense of humor. Y'all was one of my most favorite teammates of all time. You know, you talk about a guy who just worked his tail off, cared about the team, just wanted to do his job for the team. And let me tell you, Yao couldn't condition in the summer like he wanted to because of his injury problems and his feet. Mm-hmm. And so it took him a while to get in shape every year. But, you know, around Christmas time, when he finally got in NBA shape, you know, there was probably like a 4 or 5 week period, 6 week period where there was no one who could touch him. I'm talking Shaq in his prime.
He said it himself. You know,
Dwight Howard in his prime. These guys, they could not handle him. I mean, he was 30 and 20 and 7 every single night and just a monster. And the problem was he couldn't keep it up and he got fatigued because he was doing so much. And then, like, he went back to regular Yao, which is still Hall of Fame. But every year he had this stretch where he was like, oh my gosh, this guy's unstoppable. He was unstoppable. And so, you know, all the talk about his Yao Hall of Famer, absolutely. Because I saw it firsthand. There was, you know, there were weeks in the season he was the best player in the universe.
And what he's done, I think the Hall of Fame also takes into account just what you do maybe a little bit outside of the court too. The global impact, probably the NBA's second biggest market right now, if I'm not mistaken, is undeniable. So shout out to Yao. Zooming out a little bit, obviously you as one of the premier perimeter defenders in the league, Curious to hear who the guys were that maybe made you think a little bit harder, maybe made you work a little bit harder. Obviously, we know Kobe, who we'll get into later, but were there any other guys on the wing that maybe made you be the best version of you when you matched up against them?
Well, I don't know if I was the best version of me. These guys worked, made me work my ass off. Guys like Melo, obviously Melo when he was younger was an absolute monster. And Ginobili was just, he was so tough. It was so tough. I'm glad to see him in the Hall of Fame this year. Paul Pierce was a handful. I caught Dirk a little bit on the wing. LeBron. Yeah. young LeBron, young Melo. There were so many great wings. So many great wings that, Kobe was the best out of all of them. But, that was the fun part. Fun part was lacing him up and okay, who I got tonight? Okay, Melo. Okay, it's gonna be a long night. It's gonna be a long night, but hopefully I can make him work and make him take a few more shots than he wants to take and keep his efficiency down. So, that's what I miss. I miss that feeling of getting on the bus, and Marina Del Rey at the Ritz there and going to the Staples Center and being like, oh shit, I got Kobe tonight. This guy is thirsty. He's going to try to embarrass me. And there's nothing in life that replicates that feeling of like, I better bring it or I'm going to be embarrassed. And, that's the beauty of our league. So many great players and it's every single night. And that's the best thing about playing in this league for 13 years.
No hinky packet could give you any tips on Kobe.
Oh yeah. Oh, I had the full, I had, trust me, Kobe's book was super thick. Right. And what made these guys so good is they just had the green light and you knew they're getting up 20 to 30 rips a night. And you couldn't control that. All right. Yeah. So there's no one stopping these guys. All right. There's no Kobe stopper. There's no Carmelo stopper. All right. Mm-hmm. So anyone who says they were, no. The best you could hope for against these guys is to be sort of a human yellow light, okay? And get them to, again, take a ton of shots and not score a lot of points, all right? I think I did a great job. If Kobe scored 30, he took 27 shots, I did my job, mm-hmm. all right? Everyone's like, oh, Kobe had 30 or Kobe had 40. I'm 30, 35 shots. Like the points don't matter. It's the shots. Because if you're taking a lot of shots to get those points, you're not helping your team. And that's all you're trying to do is trying to drag down the efficiency of the other player because you're not stopping them. All right. Keep them off the foul line. Make them turn the ball over a few times. Those are the small plays that help you win games in the end, regardless of points. Most fans just look at the box score and see points. That's only a very small part of the story, actually. It's everything else in context that determines whether you win or lose and have success.
No Kobe stoppers, a sly dig at Ruben Patterson.
No. There's no Kobe stoppers. There might be some Kobe, yellow lights at times. Yeah, okay. But there's no one's stopping anybody at that level.
No, I agree. Okay, so regular season 53 wins. You guys grab the 5 seed in the West. You got Portland in round 1. You end up winning in 6, but games 2 through 4 really close. They're all decided by 3 points or less. What do you remember from that series? Maybe specifically a little Brandon Roy talk. I think one of the biggest what ifs of that generation. And this is when he's really ascending into that superstar level.
Yeah, well, B Roy's a monster, man, and I think he's sort of forgotten. Unfortunately, because he was an absolute handful. He's a guy who, you talk about playing at your own pace, you could never speed him up. If he got to his spots, he got the shots he wanted, and he was like a chess master out there just controlling the floor. And he was the first guy that I really, 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 I said, Sam, Daryl, give me the kitchen sink on Brandon Roy. Because interesting thing about him, he played differently in the fourth quarter. Mm-hmm. And in terms of like where he got his shots from, where he liked to catch the ball from, the pick and rolls he ran. And, that was really the first time I said, this is super interesting. And like, you just can't go play a guy. And especially in the playoffs, there's no secrets. You got to know a guy, backwards and frontwards. And just an absolute monster because he was athletic. In the fourth quarter, he's still, trying to punch it on you. And really sad that the knees just gave out, and because he would have been, I think he would have been a Hall of Famer. You know, I know Ron Artest called him the best player he ever played against, and I think he was trying to piss Kobe off. But
we were going to get to that.
But we all respected B. Roy. We all knew that he was a monster. You know, but for like, I was excited. That was the first time I'd ever been out of the playoffs. You know, mm-hmm. for as much success as I had at Duke, you know, I went to the Memphis Grizzlies. We made the playoffs three straight years. We got swept three straight years. All right, so mm-hmm. I never experienced second round. We played Utah next 2 years in Houston. I lose first round. So I'm like, man, I'm getting a little older. I need to get out of the first round. I don't want to be that guy. So, you know, we were banged up, didn't have T-Mac. And so it was an awesome series that we closed out in six. So super, super proud of that series. And, you know, then we get the Lakers all they can handle in game seven or in seven games the next round, which was a really, really fun series as well.
Quick question about just those, you know, those books on the players that you got. Do you still have those?
You know, I stole a few. So yeah. just for my own file, just going back and looking at how I used to think about guarding guys and, you know, those are, I really haven't shared those with anybody, but I have a file of the great ones just to show my kids one day. Look, I used to guard Kobe and Melo and LeBron. This is how I try to guard them.
I mean, that's great. I would love to see one of those. Lakers series, you mentioned that Ron was already trying to play mind games with him, saying, you know, Kobe's good, but I think Brandon Roy's better. I saw a hilarious and just amazing article that was published right before the series talking about the match between you, Ron, and Kobe. Kobe was saying there, I think he's quoted as, oh, you know, I torch Shane Battier every time, you know, that's no problem. You've called going up against Kobe the ultimate chess match. Obviously on the floor, we see the banging, you know, those isolations, but talk about just the mental side about going up against Kobe at this time where, you know, he's running through the West. What is that like?
Well, first of all, you know, Ron was calling Kobe out. I took the complete opposite approach. Like, I never, ever said I could guard Kobe. All right. I was kind of like Eeyore. And I wanted to be like the most passive guy. Like I had an ego. All right. I wasn't selfless. I knew I was a good defender and I knew what my skills were, but I knew like if I fire that guy up, that's bad news for me. So I went out of my way to say, oh man, Kobe just missed shots. He's had a bad game. Like it wasn't me. So that was, but like Kobe knew that. And Kobe actually wrote a page in his book, Mamba Mentality, about me. And he said, look, you know, Shane never admitted he could guard me. In fact, he downplayed like his skills, you know, and he said, but I saw through that false humility and attacked him because of it. And I read that after he passed and I started crying and laughing at the same time. So I'm like, yes, that's exactly what I was trying to do. And so the battle between Kobe and I was like the game within the game within the game within the game. The only he and I knew were playing against each other. And that's why he's my favorite, you know, player and to guard and to compete against, because it wasn't about just Lakers against the Rockets or the Grizz, whatever. It was this mental warfare game that we played with each other. And, you know, it was the best, you know, that series. Look, you know, if you go on Twitter, you go on all these people like are always killing me. Like, oh, Kobe torched Shane for 40 in game two. And like, yeah, he had a great game. But like, I looked at the numbers for that series and like, I was okay with the numbers that he scored against me. You know, he averaged like 26, 27 points, you know, shot 45% from the field, only got 6 free throws a game. And so like, those are the things I judge myself on. And I'm like, I can live with that, you know? And the thing about the story I tell, you know, I got a lot of acclaim for the hand in the face tactic.
Yep.
All right. And so people misunderstand like why I did that. Right. And especially for a guy like Kobe, I knew Kobe would go out of his way to prove that this tactic wouldn't work on him because he never wanted to admit he had a weakness. Well, what's the only way that he can prove that this doesn't work is to take a long 2-point dribble jump shot. What is Kobe Bryant's worst shot? A long 2-point dribble jump shot. So I was completely fine with him trying to prove that this tactic didn't work because he was going to his statistical weakness, right? Whether he made it or he missed it, it didn't matter to me. You know, people are like, oh, he hit that shot with the hand in the face. Like, I didn't care. All they cared about is he took that shot. And I knew if he took enough of those shots, he was never going to have like these huge, huge, huge games over a long stretch of time. All right. So like, I never reacted to one game, I wanted to see how I played against a guy over a series or a season or a career. And so like, again, that was the mental game that I played, you know, with Kobe, you know, prove it, Kobe, keep proving it. and he made a lot of jumpers. But again, I was like completely fine with the shots that he made like that. I got mad when I put him in the foul line and I gave him 12 free throws a game and I gave him a bunch of dunks and layups. Like those are the ones that I lost sleep over, not the jumpers.
I don't know if my colors aren't great, but I don't know if they're what the mix between yellow and green is. I think that's maybe what you caused him.
at times.
Is there one image, it doesn't have to be from this season, when you think of your battles on the court, one image or one small soundbite that sort of flashes into mind first?
Against Kobe or just in general?
Just a Kobe.
Oh, man. You know, it was always interesting. So Kobe, again, we're playing these mind games and, you know, before the game, you know, there's always you know, pleasantries exchange, whatnot. And there were some games from Kobe which was just so talkative to me. Hey man, what's going on? How you doing? What's going on? And then the next game, he wouldn't even look at me. And so like I chuckled to myself. I didn't care, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I'm gonna guard you regardless whether you talk to me or not. And so Kobe became like a, you know, this thing in our family. And I'll never forget, like, my son was just born and my wife was holding him after the game in Houston. And then you gotta walk by the wives and family section, go to the bus, and Kobe stops and go, and didn't know it was my wife. Like, oh man, what a good looking kid, you know, my son Zeke. And my wife's like, thanks, like, don't talk to my son. So, like, that's what I remember from that. I was like, oh, me. It became like a family thing. But incredible. It really makes me sad when he passed that we've never had this conversation. I know I would give anything to be able to have this conversation and be like, I know you're playing mind games, and he would say the same thing about me. That's why I think very highly of Kobe, and I'm just super sad that we'll never have this conversation. We'll have this conversation in the big Staples Center in the sky one day. But it's very, very, very sad, but blessed that I had a chance to play against a guy who literally pushed me to the edge.
No, I mean, I can't get enough of the Kobe stories, and I think it's great. You know, all the NBA community just keeping the legacy alive. You know, it's a big legacy that's not going anywhere. But just hearing these stories from all these different people and every single person pretty much that played in the league at the same time or shared a court with him has like an incredible, extremely detailed story about him. So thank you for sharing all that. Sort of just reflecting back, you know, on that playoff run, like how cool is it just to say in a 3 or 4 week window, you went toe to toe with two guys like Brandon Roy and Kobe in the same playoffs and held your own and then some.
Yeah. Look, we gave them all they can handle. And, you know, like I said, we had talent. We could have caused some noise, you know, that game seven against the Lakers that we lost in Staples. You know, we got blown out because we just didn't have anything else and left in the tank. And, you know, Bynum and Gasol were just, and Lamar Odom were too big. You know, we're starting Chuck Hayes at center. You know, Chuck Hayes, one of my favorite teammates of all time. But, you know, that spoke to our team that year. We just had amazing heart, amazing togetherness. You know, our coaching staff was amazing. We just got a really tough draw in the second round. I'm not saying we could have beat the Lakers, but I remember from that series that Phil Jackson actually got really upset at the press conference because people were just like, how are these Rockets even like staying in the series? And Phil Jackson goes, Chuck Hayes is a good player. All right, you show some respect on Chuck Hayes. So like, the Lakers knew and they respect us, even if the world's like, you know, how are these the little Rockets that could stand on the court with the eventual NBA champions, the Lakers with Bynum, Gasol, Kobe, and Lamar Odom.
I mean, Yao also only plays three games this series, and I'm not going to put you on the spot, but if Yao's healthy for seven, could be different.
If we had health, if we had T-Mac and Yao, I would like our chances against anybody. You know, we would have had a shot against anybody. You know, but you know, people don't talk about, you know, how great Mutombo was. All right, Mutombo, mm-hmm. again one of the greatest teammates of all time. You know, in the years that Yao would go out, Dikembe would just, like, he could barely run and lay up lines and get out there. And
50 years old.
Like, grab 15 boards and still block six shots. Like, it was the damnedest thing of all time, Mutombo. And then, you know, still to this day, like, he'd block a shot, he'd grab it, turn to the crowd, and you go, no, 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 no. And we're like, Dikembe, we're out, man. Come on, pass the ball, then finger wag. But so, like, you know, that's why that team was so awesome. You know, it didn't matter who stepped in, they produced, whether it was Dikembe Mutombo, Steve Novak, you know, Von Wafer, Carl Landry, Luis Scola. It was just a really, really cool team. But I'm glad we get a chance to talk about, because they are kind of a forgotten, we are a forgotten team in the late 2000s.
Most definitely. Sort of just reflecting back, are there any lessons or little details that you picked up maybe from this season, or just your Rocket stint in general, that you carry with you in front office now?
Yeah, look, you know, I was lucky to win two championships with the Miami Heat. And so coming from my time at Duke, the value of the locker room is super important. All right. And it's easy to be a good locker room when things are good. But if you want to be a champion, you got to go through some stuff. And it tests your ability to come together as a team, to handle adversity, to sort of figure it out. All right. Because, you know, no one's trying to help you up when you have adversity in the NBA. They're trying to step on you. Right. And it's competition. That's just the way it is. And so just having an amazing locker room, understanding how important team togetherness is something I took with me, you know, to my next team with the Heat. And we had amazing team chemistry and a great locker room. And we had adversity like everybody else, but when you have a strong team, you can overcome it. And that is still, you cannot win this championship, whether it's the Warriors this year or anybody, or the Bucks, you know, the last couple of years, you got to have a strong locker room. And there's no way around it.
Truth to that. Excuse me. Well, Shane, I really appreciate, you know, all the wisdom and taking a trip down memory lane with me. I think, like you said, the Rockets era in general, I just find really fascinating again, but this specific team going toe to toe with the eventual champs, having guys like Aaron Brooks, Kyle Lowry, like, you know, come into their own on the big stage. And of course, you and Ron's, those battles against Kobe. I want to, you know, try and keep those days and games alive. So, you know, without you, that reliving that goes away. So just thank you for hopping on and, you know, giving us so much about this season.
Well, it was a really, really fun time for me. It was my prime, I thought, as a player. And so it's fun to relive with you, Dylan. Thanks for bringing me on.
Thanks so much. And, you know, we'll look out for those front office moves with the Heat coming up.
All right. Be good.
That is a wrap. Forgotten Seasons on the 2009 Rockets with Shane Battier. I really liked that one. I think you could tell really how much pride Shane took in that Kobe matchup and going toe-to-toe with the legend. We will be back next week with another episode. Drop a rating and a review. Really appreciate it. This is your host, Dylan Dreyfus, signing off. I will catch you next Tuesday. Peace.